This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoen. George Anastasia and Glenn Macnos say that The Godfather is the best gangster movie ever made, and it's hard to argue with that. The Godfather 1 and 2 are among my favorite films. There are many things that make Coppola's classic portrait of the Corleone family great, and one is the dialogue. Here's a montage from some of the scenes.
If anything in this life is certain, if history's taught us anything, it says you can kill anyone.
Never tell anybody outside the family what you're thinking again.
Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Someday, and that day may never come, I'll call upon you to do a service for me. But until that day, accept this justice as a gift on my daughter's wedding day.
Fredo, you're my older brother, and I love you. But don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What the hell is this?
That's a Sicilian message. It means Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Well, George and Glenn have compiled a list of what they consider the top 100 gangster flicks and put them together in a new book called The Ultimate Book of Gangster Movies. George Anastasia has covered real-life gangsters as a crime writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the author of several books. He's been a guest many times on Radio Times. And, George, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Marty. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you here. And also with us is Glenn Macnow. He has a talk show on Philadelphia Sports Radio 94 WIP. And, Glenn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Times as well.
Yeah, pleasure. Very nice to see you today.
And I can see why George would like gangster movies, but Glenn, why do you like gangster movies?
Well, because I like guy movies, because I do a show that deals in guy issues and what guys like, and so a couple of years ago I wrote a book with Ray Dinger, The Ultimate Book of Sports Movies, because guys like sports. Mm-hmm. But after that, the next genre that all guys like and quote and talk to each other and take advice from are these great gangster movies.
Well, I have to say girls like them too.
Yes. Well, hey, we're more than happy if a few women buy this book.
Well, we have in the intro, when we introduced the book, we set it up by saying, welcome to any bar where guys between the ages of 21 and 65 are hanging out. They'll be talking about one of three issues, sports, movies, or women. They know a lot about two of those issues, and this is a book about one of them.
Won't say the one that they don't know anything
that's
about.
That's a given, I think.
But you say this is the sort of urban version of the Western, right?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think there's certain genres that are enduring, and I think romantic comedies, mm-hmm. Westerns, and gangster movies are the three. What do you think?
Yeah, because it started, you know, movies, back when they started, the Western was really one of the first big genres. And the outlaw was always a popular guy, or the Western hero. And so as America became more urban, it opened up the kind of room for people to watch the gangster movies. That's somebody they knew.
And the first one you say is The Musketeers of Pig Alley. And this is a movie I have never seen, the director D.W. Griffith.
Yeah, it's a 1912 movie. It's you can watch it in 17 minutes. It's easy to find on YouTube. You know, it's in public domain. And it's, in many ways, the same kind of story which is told in the gangster movies up through then. A young couple trying to make it in the tough big city, and you know, the guy's looking for a break, an immigrant not being assimilated, and he finds it with the gangs. You put on the microwave popcorn, you call this movie up on YouTube, and you'll be done with the movie before the popcorn.
Well, I do want to move on to some other movies, but George, just giving us all a chance to talk about The Godfather. And as I said, it's not just one of my favorite gangster movies. It's just, especially the first two, are just classic. It's classic movie making on just about every level.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we rank it 1-2, but it really comes as a tandem. Godfather 3 is about 75 in the book. We included it because it's not a bad film, but it always is compared to those first two, and it can't measure up.
And what's so good about the Godfather 1 and 2 from your perspective?
Well, I mean, I think so many different things, but I think, one, it really kind of set the genre in a whole new direction, and it became the template against which everything was measured. And it Puzo and Coppola got into this whole idea of family and honor and loyalty, which I think resonated with a lot of Americans, even if they weren't Italian Americans. And there was something to admire about that, even though these were gangsters. And that was the beauty of these films. These are bad guys, but we like those guys. The other interesting thing, you know, Glenn and I did a lot of research.
Yeah.
Michael Corleone and Vito Corleone could not have existed in 1930s cinema, because of the censorship and because of every gangster had to come to a bad end. It was like the 18th century French novelist. You could write about all kind of debauchery as long as your central character died in the end and suffered the fires of hell. Same thing with the movies in the 30s. And that's why Cagney always has these dramatic death scenes at the end. But Corleone, the Corleones, would not have functioned as Corleones in the 1930s.
And I do want to get to some of those older films, but just something that you say in the book is that during the filming of The Godfather, Crazy Joey Gallo, there was there was some kind of a mafia war, in New York while this while they were filming this?
That was going on, and there was also the Italian-American League, and anything that was being written about or said about the mafia, they saw it as stereotyping. And, you know, there was, I think, a lot of controversy. And Glenn wrote the Godfather 1 essay and points out that the words mafia and Cosa Nostra are not
never said in the movie. Never said in the movie. And that was one of the agreements that the studio came to with the interest groups in New York, the interest groups really being fronts for the actual mob. The studio wanted to film the movie in Cleveland or Cincinnati or someplace where it would have been much cheaper. Coppola, to his credit, insisted you do it in New York in real places with real scenes, but that set up a lot of difficulties because there was a lot of Italian-American outrage at the time.
And Coppola didn't realize what a great film he had made.
That's one of the fascinating things about The Godfather is that from the time they sold the book rights to the time the movie came out, it faced dozens of disasters. The casting almost was a disaster. I'll just give you one quick story. The studio looked at Al Pacino and Coppola saw Al Pacino in a play, said, "I want this guy." The studio said, "We don't want him. He looks too Italian," which was an interesting dynamic. They wanted to hire either Nicholson or Warren Beatty or, how about this one, Robert Redford to play Michael Corleone.
A blonde.
They didn't like Coppola. He almost got fired 4 or 5 times, even up through the editing process. And as they were making the movie, they kept looking at each other and thinking, boy, this is going to be a disaster. Uh-huh. Only when they finally put it together and started to show it did they realize they had a masterpiece.
Well, let me move on to another film. And we put them in the order that you guys have decided, although we are jumping from, I guess, 1 to number 5. This is Pulp Fiction, directed by Quentin Tarantino. This is 1994. Samuel L. Jackson plays Julius Winfield, John Travolta, Vincent Vega, their team of hitmen. And this first scene is they are together driving in a car to a violent execution, and they are talking about, of all things, hamburgers.
But you know the funniest thing about Europe is?
What?
It's the little differences. I mean, they got the same shit over there that they got here, but it's just there. It's a little different.
Example.
All right, well, you can walk into a movie theater in Amsterdam and buy a beer. And I don't mean just like a little paper cup. I'm talking about a glass of beer. And in Paris, you can buy a beer in McDonald's. And you know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?
Oh, man, they got the metric system. They wouldn't know what the f*** a quarter pounder is.
And what do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. What do they call a Whopper?
I don't know. I didn't go on a Burger King.
I swear, I could hear that. I mean, how many times have we heard that, George? And it still works.
I mean, everybody relates to that Royale. This is just a wonderful movie. And it was Quentin Tarantino, I think, took everything to another level. And we talk about that Little Caesar established, The Godfather brought it back, and then Quentin Tarantino and the guys that came after him took it in a whole other direction.
And we hear not just great dialogue, and of course, you know, these are really bad guys talking about hamburgers, but also just, Glenn, the rhythm of how they talk.
Yeah, well, that's the brilliance of that movie, the brilliance of Tarantino's movies, this one and True Romance and Reservoir Dogs, is that it draws you into this world of these fundamentally dislikable characters, hitmen and drug dealers and so on. But because they're talking about the stuff that you talk about every day, you begin to kind of associate and to a degree sympathize with them. They're talking about foot rubs. They're talking about other guys' wives. They're talking about tipping in restaurant in Reservoir Dog. It's stuff that everyday people talk about, so you are drawn to them more than you'd want.
Well, let's play another film, and this is one you both have referenced. This goes back to 1931, and this is Little Caesar, directed by Mervyn LeRoy. It's Edward G. Robinson in the classic role. He plays Caesar Enrico Bandello, and here he is discussing his future with his pal, Joe Massara, played by Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and they're preparing to head for Chicago to make it big.
Underworld pays respects to Diamond Pete Montana.
What's that got to do with the price of eggs?
Plenty. Diamond Pete Montana. He don't have to waste his time on cheap gas stations. He's somebody. He's in the big town doing things in a big way. Yeah, look at us. Just a couple of nobodies. Nothing.
Is that what you want, Rico? A party like that for you? Caesar Enrico Bandello, honored by his friends.
Well, I could do all the things that fella does and more. Only I never got my chance. Why, what's there to be afraid of? Now, when I get in a tight spot, I shoot my way out of it. Why, sure. Shoot first and argue afterwards. You know, this game ain't for guys that's soft.
And again, a classic scene from Little Caesar, and of course, Edward G. Robinson, George, in that classic role. And again, to hear his voice.
Yeah, I mean, Robinson was the kind of, and Glenn mentions this, the Joe Pesci of his day. He was the little bantam wise guy, the guy who was almost a psychopath. And Robinson played this character again and again, but I think Little Caesar is where he kind of set the bar for this. And the interesting thing, you know, Joe Massara, Douglas Fairbanks, they were going to Chicago to make it. Do you know what Joe Massara wanted to be, the character?
No.
He wanted to be a ballroom dancer, and he becomes a ballroom dancer. It's very, very bizarre when you bring 21st century sensibilities to this 1930s underworld. Today, if they remade it, he'd have to be with Dancing with the Stars, I guess.
But and Glenn, as you both had said, and you write in the book that back in the 30s, there were the censors, there was the Catholic Legion of Decency.
Oh, yeah.
Putting a lot of controls, or attempting to put controls on some of these gangster
movies. Well, it's amazing the stuff that had to happen. And Little Caesar's one, and another one is the original Scarface, the Paul Muni Scarface, which Harold Hughes directed, and Howard Hughes, excuse me, and produced, didn't direct, produced. Mm-hmm. And there was so much opposition to how he wanted to film it, what he wanted the end to be, what he wanted the character to be, that he basically walked out of Hollywood and said, I'm never doing this again. But they have to put a prologue on it that says, you know, the underworld is a terrible part of America, and you should never look up to these guys. And then, as George said, in the end, the bad guys got to die. The 90 minutes in between, at some point, you get an actual gangster movie.
Well, and movies, as you say, had to be elevating. They couldn't promote crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin.
Exactly. And at the end, you know, the classic last line, Mother of Mercy, is this the end of Rico? Original line is, Mother of God, is this the end of Rico? And the censor said, you can't say that. And when we look at the films today with Al Pacino dropping 200 F-bombs in Scarface, you say, you know, is this progress? But this is where we are, yeah.
This is where we are. Yeah. And that is George Anastasia, joins us along with Glenn Macnow. And they have collaborated on a new book. It's called The Ultimate Book of Gangster Movies. They rate them 100, the 100 top, beginning, of course, with the best and going to the worst as they see it. And George Anastasia, a crime reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Glenn Macnow, talk radio host on Sports Radio 94 WIP in Philadelphia. We're going to take a very short break and talk some more and play some more clips. In fact, we've got Waiting in the Wings, the first version of Scarface, and this is the 1932 version. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
How does where you are influence what you do? The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents Here, an exhibition that looks at how the work of contemporary artists is saturated with the experience of where they live. On view October 22nd through December 31st, Here showcases the work of 24 artists and artist collectives from 6 different regions of the country. For details, 215-972-7600 or PAFA.org.
I'm Marty Moscoen. It's the second day of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. We depend on listeners just like you to be supporters of WHYY. That's how public broadcasting works. Call 1-888-345-9499 or go online to WHYY.org and make a pledge and become a member of WHYY. It's just that simple and important. Again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
Widener University supports WHYY. At Widener University, graduate courses are taught with leadership experiences in an educational environment. In addition to academic programs, Widener stresses the real-world leadership skills employers want today. Widener delivers the means for professional advancement and personal growth students seek in a graduate program, while accommodating work schedules through a variety of graduate degrees, including nursing, education, social work, and more. Widener Leadership Works.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. So why are we so fascinated with bad guys and why do they make such compelling characters on the screen? Well, in their new book, The Ultimate Guide to Gangster Movies, Inquirer crime reporter George Anastasia and sports radio host Glenn Macnow do their countdown, their list of the 100 greatest gangster films, which they define as a movie in which the bad guys, not the police, are the central characters. And we have pulled some selections from their book, and we are playing them today on Radio Times. Well, we have mentioned the original Scarface. This is Scarface, The Shame of a Nation, which was made in the early 1930s, directed by Howard Hawks and Richard Rawson. Paul Muni plays mobster Tony Camonte, and here he is explaining to his boss, Johnny Lovo, how he's going to take over the bootlegging business in the north side of Chicago.
Hey, where do you think you're going?
To the north side, like I always knew someday.
You can't do that.
What do you mean, can't? Who's stopping me?
I am. I'm giving you orders for the last time.
There's only one thing that gets orders and gives orders, and this is it. That's how I got the south side for you, and that's how I'm going to get the north side for you. Some little typewriter, eh? I'm going to write my name all over this town with it in big letters.
Hey, stop him, somebody.
Get out of my way, Johnny. I'm going to spit.
And there's that gunfire. Glenn, as you were saying, Howard Hughes, this was, I guess, his original idea, but walked away because of his problems with the Hays office.
Yeah, there was so much censorship in this. He wanted to take it all to another level of what gangster movies had been, which was, in his mind, a certain realism and a real grittiness that you would find these days. And obviously, in those days, none of the censorship boards or the Catholic League of Decency would allow that. So everything was a fight.
And this is a movie that got no MPAA rating?
Well, they didn't have MPAA ratings back then, but he didn't get approval from anything. The movie, it was released without the Hays office endorsement, which is basically like releasing an X-rated movie now.
Right.
You're going to really reduce your audience. It was banned in 7 states. It was banned in Chicago, of all places. And so it didn't get the exposure that it probably should have.
And this is the story of Al Capone. George.
And this and Little Caesar are both Al Capone. And it's amazing. Probably no other real-life character has been portrayed in as many gangster movies as Capone. I mean, there were movies called Capone and The Untouchables. Capone is one of those figures that is iconic, and the film industry just jumped on that because he embodied so much of what this underworld was.
And it was called Scarface, The Shame of a Nation.
They had to add The Shame of a Nation.
Well, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, it was called Scarface. And then because of everything that had to happen, they had to do The Shame of the Nation. They had to put this prologue at the beginning that says you don't want to admire these people.
Well, and Glenn, you were saying during the break that actually when you look at this film, you see something that they did get past the censors, which is equally as troubling as violence.
Yeah, it's astounding because the Hays Commission took out all this violence and so on. But when you watch the movie, there is obviously an incestuous relationship between Paul Muni's character of Tony Camonte and his sister. He slaps around a guy who wants to dance with his sister. He murders his sister's husband. And the very last scene has he and his sister embracing as gunfire is about to kill them. This was, if you see the later Scarface with Al Pacino, it was kind of used as a plot device in that movie also. But if you look at this movie today and you see what is clearly an incestuous relationship, you're thinking, I guess the censors didn't see it.
They weren't looking for it, maybe. You know, yeah, that's the thing.
Now, was this original Scarface, George, in spite of what the censors had to say, was this a popular film when it came out?
I think, but it had the limited distribution that Glenn was talking about, so I think it didn't become as big as, for example, Little Caesar.
Right.
And I think that's part of the reason.
But it's interesting when you look at Little Caesar, and this is the 30s, this is Prohibition. I mean, that it's really right. a kind of a social commentary on what's going on in the country at that time.
Well, absolutely. I think these movies got into all of that, and as Glenn mentioned before, it's a theme. The immigrant comes into this country, doors are closed to him, he gets involved in organized crime, he makes his way up the ladder and becomes a success in those terms. But in the 30s, that success had to end with terrible failure, and we see it again and again in all these movies.
And Prohibition and the Depression really helped build the gangster movie, because Depression also made Americans very out of favor, or made the government very out of favor with Americans, so they could root for the outlaw and not feel so bad about it.
Did you guys fight a lot of, I mean, I don't mean fist fight, but did you guys argue, disagree a lot about in what order to put these films?
I think we were pretty much on board with the top five or six. Right. I think the biggest dispute we had was over Scarface, the Pacino version. And were it up to me, it wouldn't have made the top 20. I think were it up to Glenn, it would have been in the top 10. It ranks at 16.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that debate, because I do want to get to that. But before that, I do want to play a scene from Mean Streets. Mm. Now, you give this, looks like number 14, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Okay, and this is directed by Martin Scorsese. It came out in 1973. Harvey Keitel plays Charlie. He's the nephew of a mobster in New York's Little Italy. Robert De Niro plays his boyhood friend, a guy named Johnny Boy. He's basically a neighborhood screw-up, as you describe him in your book. And here's a scene where Johnny's explaining to Charlie why he's late on his payment to a loan shark. Let's listen.
What's the matter with you, Johnny? You kick around bullshit people that way. If you're worried about something, you got to keep it.
You don't know what happened to me. I'm so depressed about other things, I can't worry about payments. You know what I mean? I come home last Tuesday, I had my money to catch, huh? Blah, blah, bing, bing. Coming home, I ran into Jimmy Sparks. That was Jimmy Sparks 700, like for 4 months. I got to pay the guy. Lives in my building, hangs out across the street. I got to pay the guy, right?
Yeah.
So what happened? I had to give some to my mother, and then I wound up with 25 at the end of the week. And then what happened today, you ain't going to believe, because it's just incredible. I can't believe it myself.
What?
I was in a game. I had like $600-$700, right?
You got to be kidding
me. Yeah, Hester Street. You know Joey Clams?
Yeah.
Joey Scala, yeah.
I know him too, yeah.
Yeah, Joey Scala is Joey Clams.
Right.
Right.
They're the same person.
Yeah.
Hey.
Hey. So I was in there playing bankers and brokers. All of a sudden, I'm ahead like $600-$700. I'm really winning. All of a sudden, some kid walks in, and the kid yells that the bulls have come, right? Now the cops have come. Everybody runs away. I grab all the money. I go in. It's an excuse, like, to get away.
Right.
You know, and I give everybody the money back later. And that way I get out. I don't have to get into the game and get a losing streak and all that. What happens? I come out of the yard. I don't know this building. Meek, I don't know nothing. Couldn't get out. It was like a box.
And on and on and on and on and on.
He goes, great dialogue.
You gotta love it. You gotta love it.
Now, it feels, I mean, it's Robert De Niro, so it feels real. It feels almost improv.
Well, you gotta remember, this comes out a year after The Godfather, and it's almost the antithesis. This is the mob and the wise guys from the street level.
Right.
And that's what Scorsese tapped into. De Niro's great, Harvey Keitel is great. And this is kind of a precursor. If you look at this, and when you're watching this now, you know all the other Scorsese, De Niro, the whole masterpiece of work. This was the first one, and so you see little bits and pieces of what's coming, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, and who's playing who in this scene, right, Glenn?
Yeah, and it's great. And just to kind of piggyback off of what he said, this was Scorsese's and De Niro's kind of breakout. Scorsese is in our book, five of our top 22 movies are Scorsese movies, and De Niro is the actor who's in our book most in 11 different movies. Now, some of them in the key number one roles, Godfather Part Two, and some of them it's kind of a bit actor who steals the movie.
But there's this is a history of a great collaboration on a certain kind of character that they seem to do so well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And those two guys, De Niro we talk about this at another point in the book. Has there ever been a director and actor that you can put together as successfully as those two? And we don't think there is. We think this is the all-timer.
And they're coming right out of their neighborhood here. I mean, both De Niro and Scorsese are from the neighborhood in Little Italy in New York where this is set. So I think in a lot of ways it's just...
They knew Joey Clams.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they really tapped into what they knew here, and they brought it to the screen.
Now, you also say that this film was made for $600,000, which is amazing, even for back in 1973. And, George, also using handheld cameras, which, of course, gives it a kind of documentary...
Yeah, and sometimes it's a little disconcerting, and you got to go with that because the film's so good. But, yeah, they did this on the cheap. and it became a classic, a masterpiece.
A masterpiece. Well, I do want to hear about your argument about Scarface, and this is the 1983 version directed by Brian De Palma. I do want to play a clip, but first... Right.
You can actually play a clip from that movie?
Well, I know, and we should say, and I have to give Patty Leswing and Susan Greenbaum actually a shout-out, because they spent a lot of time doing surgery on a lot of these clips, including from Scarface as well. But 1983 is this movie. One thing to you, though, George, yeah. You say, and you've interviewed a lot of gangsters. I mean, part of your beat has been the crime beat, that gangsters, real-life gangsters, identify a lot with Tony Montana.
It's ironic. I think the drug underworld Pacino character, Tony Montana, is the one they look to. The wise guys look to Pacino in the Corleone character. But yeah, Pacino has created training films, in a sense, for the underworld. Yeah,
I find that very disturbing.
Yeah.
But they see this guy who's ruthless,
right?
Violent,
right? Big guns and a lot of women, a lot of bling, a lot of money, and take what you want when you want it. That's Tony Montana.
So what was the disagreement between the two?
Well, the disagreement was that, to me, this may not be the greatest movie ever made, but it is one of the most iconic movies ever made. And all these years later, people who weren't even alive when this movie came out quote the lines, hang the poster on their wall, you know, watch it again and again, and all I need to say is, you know, say hello to my little friend, which everybody has quoted, and it remains to me a cultural icon, which I would have pushed it up because of that.
Okay, and then you I guess, came to a consensus on number 16?
Yeah, we compromised.
And where would you have put it, George?
I would have put it outside the top 20, maybe 25, 26.
And why is that?
Because I think just because it's iconic doesn't mean it's a good movie. I think the movie loses its way, and the second half of the movie is Pacino dropping F-bombs and shooting people.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting narrative, an interesting way to remake the story, but I think... Then they got caught up in the shooting.
Ah, but that. The size of that bazooka.
Spoken like real boys here on Radio Times. There's a chainsaw scene
that's horrific. And that was dramatic. But as we went on, we got into, I think, more, it got too violent.
Well, here's something highly edited that we can play for the radio from Scarface. Again, a film that came out in 1983, directed by Brian De Palma, a remake of the classic Scarface, The Shame of a Nation. Al Pacino playing a cold-blooded killer, a cocaine kingpin named Tony Montana. And here he is in a restaurant after he's had a fight with his girlfriend, Elvira.
You need people like me so you can point your fingers. I say, that's the bad guy. So? What I make you? Good? You're not good. You just know how to hide. How to lie. Me, I don't have that problem. Me, I always tell the truth. Even when I lie.
Come on, George.
Yeah, I was going to say, George, come on.
We got to move it up a little bit.
No, I'm sticking to my guns.
So what do you think? What do you think of that accent?
Well, both of the Pacino accents in this and Carlito's Way are a little off-putting. I don't think he quite nails it. I don't think he quite nails it, and I think it's too obvious that he's trying to make the effort to do it. And I don't know,
I think it's way over the top. I won't argue that it's way over the top, but it's fun. And this, to me, is it's terrible to say it's a fun movie, but this is the kind of movie that people watch it again and again.
Yeah.
I've seen it 20
times.
And
what was it rated when it came out?
R, hard
rated
R.
Hard
yeah,
R.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, 16 is not bad in the ratings. We got 16 at that.
I'm laughing to keep from crying here because it's a terrifying movie. But let me move on.
Yeah.
And actually going back to Martin Scorsese, and this is The Gangs of New York, a film that came out in 2002. Now, you guys put this at number 22. And this is Daniel Day-Lewis. He's playing Bill the Butcher. It also stars Leonardo DiCaprio playing his protege, a young guy named Amsterdam. And let me play a scene from this. It's a short one, but it gives us, I think, a flavor for this really scary character, Bill the Butcher, and here's Bill giving Amsterdam a lesson.
Somebody steals from me, I cut off his hands. He offends me, I cut out his tongue. He rises against me, I cut off his head, stick it on a pike. Raise it high up so all in the streets can see. That's what preserves the order of things. fear.
Now that's an accent, George.
Yeah, that works. I think that works very well.
And you know how he did that accent? There's some great backstory to this movie. First of all, it's based on a book, The Gangs of New York, which was published, I think, right around the turn of the century, that Scorsese had found as a young man and always wanted to do a movie off of. And Daniel Day-Lewis, who's one of the great method actors of all time, went to the New York Public Library, said, I need to find out how people in New York sounded in the 1860s. So they actually found some old recordings. Walt Whitman is one of the voices that he listened to. There were early recordings of Walt Whitman, and he listened to get the accent that he used.
Wow, imagine Leaves of Grass.
A little bit different. But he wanted it to be genuine, and so he found that old accent.
Now, he's a wonderful actor. The cast in this movie is fantastic. I've read the book. The book is a little difficult to read. But it's amazing that Scorsese was able to take that and get this movie out of that.
But as you say in this chapter on this movie, that Scorsese takes a fair amount of liberty with some of this history. And we're talking about the 19th century and immigration and New York and Little Five Points, all of that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of there are actual facts that occur, and the Know Nothing Party, which was the anti-immigration group that Bill the Butcher led, actually takes place. But you see the draft riots that take place during the movie. Bill the Butcher was actually dead when those took place. Bill the Butcher is actually about as factually accurate, as relevant as Joe the Plumber would have been at the time. But nonetheless, he puts together fragments of it to make an amazingly entertaining story and a movie that does reflect some of the history of the time.
And it's, I mean, the kind of violence, I guess, because we're talking knives, you know, that's, which is different from machine guns, but it I find it just almost unbearable.
Well, I think the brutality is right out there, and that's one of the things that makes this such an intriguing movie.
We did a body count. One of the things we do for every chapter. By the way, one of the things we do for every chapter is have best line, and you played the one that we thought was the best line for this movie. But we also did something called body count. So as George and I watched each movie, we literally sat there and would draw one, two, three. This one stopped at about number 100 because that was 20 minutes into the movie, and there was no way we were going to get an accurate
count. You ran out of room for your marks. What about foreign films? I mean, there are certainly foreign films, and you talk about their films from Asia, their films from Australia, their films from Europe, France, I'm thinking of, Georgia. Do they approach this gangster from a different perspective?
That's interesting. I think we found a different type of genre within, a subgenre within. Each country seems to have their own way of presenting the gangster. The French are, I think, a little more sophisticated and introspective. I've found the British films even more treacherous and violent.
Bleak, yeah.
Glenn did the Japanese movies, which were...
Oh, yeah.
The Japanese movies were brutal and violent in a way that after you see them, you just kind of want to take a shower. I spent a weekend watching 19 Japanese gangster movies.
Wow.
And afterward, I just wanted to watch Mary Poppins for a couple of weeks.
But we're talking beyond John Woo, right? We're talking about...
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Well, actually, you go back to Japanese, we have an Akira Kurosawa movie called Drunken Angel from the 40s, which is a great, great movie about the Japanese Yakuza. But we have movies from 12 other countries other than the United States on the list, and not just the expected ones. There's a movie from Russia, from Mexico, from Australia, a great movie from a year or two ago. Called Animal Kingdom, as well as Italy, Germany, Japan.
And we were tempted to play Animal Kingdom only because it features a woman as the head of a crime family. Yeah. Jackie Weaver was nominated for an Oscar for her performance in that. We just couldn't find the right clip that really showed off her malevolence.
She's a terrifically terrifying kind of grandmotherly head of a Melbourne mob drug family. And if people haven't seen the movie Animal Kingdom, it's a great one to rent.
Well, let's take another short break. We're going to get back to our conversation with George Anastasia and Glenn Macnow. They have collaborated on a new book called The Ultimate Guide to Gangster Movies. And we are, in a sense, counting backwards from what they consider the best to perhaps the worst. And George Anastasia, a crime reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Glenn Macnow, a talk radio host on Sports Radio 94 WIP that's here in Philadelphia. And we're going to take a very short break. And then when we get back, we'll be playing a selection from A History of Violence. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Beethoven's Seventh Symphony has endured for almost two centuries. The Philadelphia Orchestra, under Charles Dutoit, performs Beethoven's Seventh, plus the Violin Concerto of Sibelius with Julian Rachlin. For your Beethoven tickets, 215-893-1999, online at philorc.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Dutoit conducts Beethoven's Seventh with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's the second day of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. We depend on listeners just like you to be supporters of WHYY. That's how public broadcasting works. Call 1-888-345-9499 or go online to WHYY.org and make a pledge and become a member of WHYY. It's just that simple and important. Again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Abington Friends School, a Quaker College preparatory school from preschool through grade 12. Abington Friends is diverse and multicultural. Their lower school director is co-chair for the People of Color Conference hosted by the National Association of Independent Schools. Five of their faculty will be presenting on topics related to equity and justice. At AFS, the curriculum is collaborative, relevant, and ambitious. AFS, Educating for a Changing World, open house October 15th. More at abingtonfriends.net.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with George Anastasia and Glenn Macnow. And the actual name of their new book is The Ultimate Book of Gangster Movies. And it's the 100 greatest gangster films of all times, not the best to the worst, as I was indicating. And we are playing selections from some of these movies. And in fact, let me play a scene from The Untouchables. And again, this goes back to 1987. Our guests make this number 28. It's a film directed by Brian De Palma. Kevin Costner plays Elliot Ness. Sean Connery, who won the 1987 Best Supporting Actor Oscar, plays Irish cop Jimmy Malone. And here they are discussing how to get Al Capone.
You said you wanted to know how to get Capone. Do you really want to get him? You see what I'm saying? What are you prepared to do?
Everything within the law.
And then what are you prepared to do? If you open the ball on these people, Mr. Nash, you must be prepared to go all the way. Because they won't give up the fight until one of you is dead.
I want to get Capone. I don't know how to get him.
Want to get Capone? Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way. And that's how you get Capone. Now, do you want to do that? Are you ready to do that? I'm making you a deal. Do you want this deal?
I have sworn to put this man away with any and all legal means at my disposal, and I will do so.
And that's a scene from The Untouchables. And, shout out to Sean Connery there, George.
Very, very well acted. And this is one of the movies where De Niro had the smaller part, but when he's on screen, you can't not watch him.
Well, and there's a terribly violent scene featuring, he plays Al Capone.
Right, right.
A dinner scene.
The baseball bat scene.
The baseball bat scene.
Everybody remembers it, which is the baseball bat scene, which, by the way, was a true actual incident with Al Capone, who did that a couple of years into his reign to when he had learned that a couple of his guys had ratted on him.
Yeah.
He killed them publicly in front of all of his other men to show fear.
You say this is an uninspired plot line for this movie, The Untouchables. Class.
Yeah, that's why we rated it 28, because the movie has some of the great scenes in any gangster movie history, the baseball bat scene being one of them, the death of Sean Connery, Jimmy Malone being another one of them. There are great scenes in it, but there's virtually no historical accuracy. Mm-hmm. You take the story, everybody knows the story of Elliot Ness and Al Capone, and you could have stayed with the facts and made a great movie. But they didn't, and they decided that, you know, this was more fun, and so they go up to Canada and ride around on horses for a while, and they do all kind of things that never actually happened, and that cost it in our eyes because you didn't have to invent history.
Well, and there is a great scene. It's a visual scene, so we obviously can't play it on the radio, George. This is the train station scene, an homage to the Potemkin, where we see in slow motion the baby carriage.
Exactly,
these things happening in a train station.
Yeah, I mean, I think this movie, the parts are better than the whole. I think that's what we came away with in terms of our interpretation of all of this.
I just want to tell you one thing about that scene, because it is a great scene.
Yes.
It was improvised, because De Palma actually wanted to have two trains crash in that scene. That was his idea for the scene, and the studio said, we're not paying for that. They had already rented out Union Station in Chicago, so they said, you know, there was that great scene back in the Battleship Potemkin. Let's just kind of play off of that, and they made it up in one long night.
Well, we're going to close things out, and we're not there yet with the music from The Untouchables, and it's... I think it's
Enrico Morricone.
It's absolutely beautiful music. Well, in the meantime, let me play a clip from A History of Violence. Now, you guys rate this film number 37, and it came out in 2005. It's directed by David Cronenberg. A complicated plot. Viggo Mortensen plays a guy named Joey Cusack, a brutal, actually, Irish mobster from Philadelphia, but he's created a new life for himself in a small town, and he's living as a guy known as Tom Stahl, running a family diner. Philly gang leader Carl Fogarty, in the scene he's played by Ed Harris, shows up one day and confronts Tom, a.k.a. Joey, at work. Let's listen.
It's good coffee.
Thank you, sir.
Well, to find coffee that's good in Philadelphia. But you know that, don't you, Tom?
No, actually, I don't. I've never been to Philadelphia. Pennsylvania? Is that where you gentlemen are from?
Yeah, like you don't know.
Sir, do you think we know each other?
You tell me.
No. We don't know each other.
Come on, Joey, cut the crap.
My name is Tom.
Joey Cusack. Your name is Joey Cusack. You're from Philly.
Okay. Whatever.
That's a great scene. I mean, I think that really works. We had Ed Harris in a couple of years ago when he was coming through town and played that scene, and it's just a riveting scene.
It's a chilling scene because when you're watching the movie as the audience, you don't actually know that at the time that he is Joey Cusack from Philadelphia, and this is a guy who was a mob hitman who walked away, disappeared, and created his own life 1,000 miles away in small-town Indiana, and now because of circumstances, he's getting dragged back in.
And everyone thinks he's a good guy, and he's got this malevolent past.
Yeah, and it's the fundamental question in the underworld. Can you walk away from this life? I mean, that's the theme of this movie, and I think it portrays it very well. It's very dramatic.
And from the people that you have interviewed, walk away from this life in real life?
Well, I mean, this character, I think, embodies what you need to do. You need to totally disassociate yourself and decide on your own. Nobody can help you do it. Nobody can make you do it. But if you want to do it, you can. But you always run this kind of risk that it's going to come
someone's
back
gonna
and bite you.
Someone's going
to
find you.
Yeah, yeah.
The only thing we didn't like about this movie was the Philadelphia accent.
Yeah, they were
terrible. The scenes where they come to Philadelphia, they sound like they're in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
We know a Philadelphia accent.
Yes, we do. Yeah,
and they didn't get it at all.
Right. And William Hurt, I guess.
William Hurt
was... embarrassing, actually.
And the movie co-stars Maria Bello, who's from this area.
Yeah.
They should have just listened to her family.
Yeah.
Well, didn't he say that he did?
He said he did. I've never met her family, but that sure didn't sound Philadelphia to me.
And Mortensen and Cronenberg also did another movie we have in the book called Eastern Promises that is very, very good. It's the Russian mob in London. And it's got that almost same kind of rhythm. It's a dark and has a lot of interesting twists at the end that I don't want to give away. But I think Mortensen had a great performance. And there's a scene in that movie where he's in a sauna naked.
I was just going to say.
And has a knife fight.
It's horrifying.
Just, oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's the Eastern Promises is the only movie in this book where I think there are six bodies. Nobody is shot. Nobody uses a gun in Eastern Promises. It's all knives. It even makes it more disturbing.
Well, I don't know if you all did you sit and watch all this stuff together?
No. We George and I we've seen all the movies in the book, each of us clearly over the years, but we ended up having what would be the equivalent, being a sports guy, of a draft. And we picked, and we went back and forth. And so we wrote chapters. We would edit each other's chapter and offer input and say, you know, maybe this and so on. But we divvied up the 100 chapters.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. The draft was a lot of fun. picking what we're going to do.
Yeah. Well, now we're going to go to something a little more lighthearted, and Woody Allen getting into the gangster business here. But as you write in this book, he had a couple of clunkers before Bullets Over Broadway. George, you want to just fill in some of the blanks there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Allen.
Blanks. Yeah, oh, well, sorry about that.
No, I mean, I think Woody Allen was this was the Woody Allen movie without Woody Allen starring in it. And then Cusack, John
Thank
Cusack.
Goodness,
right.
In a way.
Cusack plays the role that Woody Allen would have played, and I think this was a smart move on Woody Allen's part because he had gotten too old to do these movies. But I think Cusack, number one, Chaz Palminteri, number two. I mean, it just was fascinating. And this was, in a lot of ways, kind of a shot at the movie industry. Right. That's what this was about.
And art, even,
yeah.
On top of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we interviewed Chaz Palminteri for the book, obviously more for another movie than this movie, yeah. But he loved playing this role because he kind of identified with the character he got to play. He grew up in a tough neighborhood surrounded by gangsters, but he always wanted to be an artist, and so he gets to play both in the movie.
Well, this is a scene that's a little complicated, but we've got John Cusack. He's a struggling playwright. We've got Jack Warden as a producer. Joe Vitarelli is a mobster, and Jennifer Tilly playing a girlfriend named Olive. And in this scene, there's a lot of back and forth, and they're trying to figure out who's going to be who's going to have this starring role or who's going to be in a show in exchange for a starring role for his girlfriend, Olive. Let's listen.
Nick Valenti. Say hello to David Shane.
Hello.
David, how
hello.
Are you?
Hello, I'm Olive.
This is Olive Neal.
Charm.
Come on
charm,
in.
Charm, charm.
Come on in.
Hey,
Dave, she read your play.
Yes,
she thinks
read
it's
your
great.
Play. It's thrilling, turbulent, a really page turner, charm. Charm, charm, charm.
She's a great little actress, you know. Just
so,
great.
What have you been in, Miss?
Olive. Call me Olive, honey.
Olive, you're experienced?
Well, I had a little
experience. No
experience. I do too.
She's a master.
I have two. I have experience.
He ain't talking dancing.
He doesn't know what he's talking about.
You don't
know
mean
what
dancing,
you're talking
you?
About.
Well, she used to wiggle at this joint in Hoboken, you know? Mm. Pick up quarters off the table.
Hey!
Tops with her.
Hey!
I'm just trying
hey!
To break
butt
the
ice. Butt out, why
right?
don't you? They're talking to me.
Want a drink?
I'll have a double anything.
Great.
No, I've an old
Venus, a double whiskey.
Make it two, Venus.
Do you want the blue stuff or the green?
The imported dummy.
Oh, you mean from the clean bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
You know,
that
we had a real
that
debate about
great.
Whether comedies should even be, and there's a couple friends of Glenn's who argued that comedies don't figure in mob movies.
Yeah,
we obviously disagree. I don't think there's a place for it.
Oh, yeah, we it's a really fun movie, as is another I know we're going to talk about. And just let me bring up one actor who's in that scene. Joe Vitarelli is her boyfriend, right? And Joe Vitarelli is a guy who's going to be in the next movie you mentioned, I think. Was not an actor, was a New York businessman. At age 52, he kind of got discovered. And after that, he was in 26 movies in about 12 years before he passed at a young age, always playing a gangster and always a laugh, always great.
That's great. And I love the charm, charm,
yes.
charm. That is just perfect. Well, let me play another scene, and this is, again, a more lighthearted take. This is Analyze This, going back to 1999, directed by Harold Ramis. Crime boss Paul Vitti, and of course played by Robert De Niro, hires a New York psychiatrist, Ben Sobel, and here they are discussing Freud and Paul's father problem.
What was the relationship like? Were you very close?
Yeah, you know, we were pretty close. We weren't getting along that great right then.
Why is that?
I was hanging out in the neighborhood at Bugada.
What is that?
Like a kid gang, hooligan. Nothing big, but he didn't like that. So.
He didn't approve?
Nah, he slapped me around a couple of times.
And what?
And then he died.
Hmm. How did that make you feel?
It felt great. It was a wonderful feeling. How did it make me feel? What do I know?
Think about it. Were you angry? Were you afraid? Sad?
Man, maybe all those things.
Any feelings of guilt?
About what? I didn't kill him.
I know that, but I'm just speculating, Paul, that maybe in some way you may have wanted him to die.
Why would I want my father to die?
Well, you said that you were fighting. He slapped you around because you were rebelling against his authority. There may have been some unresolved Oedipal conflict.
English.
Oedipus was a Greek king who killed his father and married his mother.
F***ing Greeks.
It's an instinctual developmental drive. The young boy wants to replace his father so that he can totally possess his mother.
What are you saying? That I wanted to f*** my mother?
No, it's a primal fantasy.
Have you ever seen my mother?
Paul,
are you out of your f***ing mind?
It's Freud.
Well, then Freud's a sick f***, and you are too for bringing it up.
And again, of course, Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro, a scene from Analyze This, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And it's the middle of our membership campaign. Good morning, I'm Eugene Son, audio news director here at WHYY. Alongside?
I'm Debbie Builder, one of the producers. This is so fun listening to these clips. I'm just laughing along. The last clips are just really, really funny. The double anything from the clean bathtub, and then this great clip from Analyze This.
It's a great showcase of the lighthearted side of Radio Times, and we know that our listeners to Radio Times value both the serious and the lighthearted side. If that describes you, please call and make a pledge to support Radio Times at 888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at whyy.org.
Yeah, we're here to ask for your support for this show. We're not going to do our Don Corleone imitations or anything like that. You don't have to worry. But do please give us a call. Give your support for this show. Again, what you're saying, we do light stuff that you can laugh along to and hear really interesting inside stuff. I didn't know that Robert Redford, they were thinking about him to play the role for Michael Corleone, which I can't imagine it. But anyway, so thank goodness that didn't work out. But sort of getting the inside story on a lot of these great gangster movies. So give us a call. Show your support. Show us that you appreciate these kinds of programs that you can hear on Radio Times. 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY.
During this membership drive, we're trying to raise $675,000. We're expecting about 6,800 people need to join in order to get there. How do we get there? Those are really big numbers. We get there one pledge at a time. Someone just like you is listening and says, you know what, I really would miss Marty Moskowitz's Radio Times if it weren't on the air every weekday morning. So I'm going to call and I'm going to make a pledge of support, and I'm going to help keep that program not only on the air, but keep it growing and keep it strong. And the way you can do that is dialing 888-345-9499. That's 888-345-WHYY. It's quick, it's easy, and it's simple. It takes about 90 seconds or so. If you've never done this before, we just call in, you tell us your name and your address and how much you'd like to pledge and whether you'd like to put it on a credit card.
Maybe a little imitation there too. They can do their own membership. I think that volunteer would listen to that.
Definitely. whatever gangster you want to cite, give us a call. 888-345-9499.
And you're a listener to Radio Times. You know we don't just do gangster movies. We covered the Middle East. In fact, this week we covered the world. We did. We had recent Nobel Peace Prize winner Lame Bowie to talk about Liberia, her efforts at peace in Liberia. We went to Denali National Park with the chief climbing ranger there. We did the state of the Republican Party in Philadelphia. We covered local politics. We had Russell Banks, a great novelist, in as well. So Radio Times, we cover a range of programs, 2 hours every day, 500 shows a week. Give us a call.
A year.
Oh my gosh. It's hard enough. 10 shows a week. Give us a call. Become a member. 1-888-345-9499. You can go online to